Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In Washington, budgets are supposed to be passed each year, but increasingly Congress has been relying on the passage of continuing resolutions to keep the lights on. That has to happen by October 1st of each year. It did not happen last night, so the federal government has shut down. But in North Carolina, it doesn't work that way. Our government doesn't shut down even when a budget fails to pass, and that is the case right now. The fiscal year started in July, and yet Republicans in the House and those in the Senate cannot agree on what to fund or by how much. They've had many opportunities. The legislature has come into and gone out of session several times over the last few months, but still, no budget, and that is holding up teacher and state worker pay raises and putting in jeopardy funding for the Medicaid program, relied upon by hundreds of thousands of residents. Legislators had a chance to finalize that budget last week, but instead turned their attention to passing crime legislation, reinstating the death penalty, and allotting more money for Hurricane Helene relief, while leaders began discussing the possibility of following Texas's lead and redrawing voting districts again prior to next year's midterms. So here to catch us up on all the goings-on and the things not going on in Raleigh, we welcome back Brian Anderson, whose Anderson Substack newsletter covers all things swirling around North Carolina politics. Also with us is Kyle Ingram, politics reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer, and Adam Wagner, editor and reporter for NC Newsroom, which is a journalism collective which WFAE is part of. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
So, you're welcome. So, Brian, before we launch into what the legislators did last week, let's talk about what they didn't do and why. The impasse over the budget is among House and Senate Republicans. The Democrats are kind of out of this equation. Why can't these two bodies of Republicans seem to iron out their differences? And why does there seem to be so little urgency about doing so?
Well, thanks for having me. In two words, tax cuts. That's the big holdup. Right now, there's some differences between what House Republicans want and what Senate Republicans want. This is really a battle between an intra-party battle. This isn't a Republican versus Democrat fight right now. And the holdup is on some of these other things like Medicaid funding. There's some very tiny differences even on things that both chambers agree on. So with Medicaid, they agree that there should be more money to help fund the Medicaid rebase, but they disagree on how to do it, where the Senate wants like a children's hospital, the House just wants a clean bill. So there's a lot of disagreements. The broader budget fight comes to tax cuts. Some of these other issues are even as simple as disagreeing on a children's hospital.
So we're going to talk about that. So, Kyle, these tax cuts, what seems to be the bugaboo? I mean, what does one group want? What does the other group want? Why can't they find some middle ground?
Well, this has become a frequent impasse between the House and the Senate over recent years, even as they've been dominated by Republicans since 2011. The Senate tends to want more aggressive tax cuts than the House. And recently, when House Speaker Dustin Hall spoke to reporters, he said that earlier agreements on more aggressive tax cuts just don't make sense anymore with inflation. He blames the Biden administration for inflation raising in 2023, says we have to ease up on some of those tax cuts. And the House also wants higher raises in a lot of cases for teachers and state workers than the Senate is willing to agree to.
Wow. So, Adam, this has been going on for the better part of the year, and we're coming toward the end of the year. We're now in the fourth quarter as of this morning. How long are they likely to defer a decision on passing a budget? Because this budget goes into effect when it goes into effect. It is allegedly in effect for 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, they could go for the full 2 years. They don't need to pass a budget. North Carolina has a provision in its law that if the General Assembly doesn't pass a new budget, funding levels continue at the prior year. So that takes some heat off of the legislators right now. But it does mean that things like state employee raises aren't happening. And that's especially kind of in question right now with the state health plan getting more expensive. this coming year.
Teacher and state employee pay raises are hanging in the balance, as you've already mentioned, Brian, as is funding for the Medicaid program. We have heard, what have we heard from teachers and state employees about these raises being held up? Are they upset? Are they pushing for this? What are they saying?
Yeah, they're not happy, understandably so. And, you know, we talked just about Destin Hall's comments on inflation. Well, that affects everyday North Carolinians like teachers too, and they're not getting raises that can keep up with the pace of inflation. And the governor and the House Republicans are pretty much in line that there should be a sizable increase in teacher pay. The Senate wants a very, very small teacher pay raise, and there are step-up increases that were approved, meaning like, let's say I've been a teacher for 3 years and now I've been a teacher for 4 years. Well, if there's a salary difference between that, that is reflected, but that's not really a raise. That's just kind of reflecting the salary schedule with your years of experience. So that has happened, but that's pretty much it. So cost of living adjustments, teacher pay raises, those are some of the things that are unfortunately impacted by this budget impasse.
This gets a little sticky when we start talking about Medicaid. There are cuts to Medicaid that were scheduled to go into effect today. And you report, Brian, that the House passed a bill providing some additional funding to sidestep those cuts, but they did not consider a Senate proposal, which included funding for North Carolina's Children's Hospital and the ECU-UNC Rural Healthcare Partnership. So Medicaid cuts are set to proceed. And you report that both the House and Senate agree that more funding is needed, but they can't exactly agree on how much. Is this more about funding for that children's hospital, or is it more about the fact that Republicans were reluctant to come to the Medicaid table in the first place, and they don't really care whether it continues in its current form?
I mean, I think the story for Medicaid recipients is that they're just not getting their benefits. I think the story for us wonky political reporters is just, you know, there was a lot of optimism going into this session. You know, we don't have House Speaker Tim Moore. We have a new House Speaker. That means Berger and Hall are going to get along great, right? Things are going to progress on time. We'll have budgets on time. Not so much. And so I think the issue that you have seen in part is with a new House Speaker, he has new legislative priorities than his predecessor does. And you're seeing that play out where maybe Berger was caught off guard, frankly, by that. And I think that has been a big trend line to follow, to keep following. But the important thing is this is the first budget fight between these two leaders going at it for really the first time. And so I think there's the other plain reality is that when it comes to tax cuts and the Senate wanting steeper tax cuts, if they do nothing, then previously approved tax cuts continue to happen. So there's really not much incentive for the Senate to come to the table. And if you're the House, you want to make your mark as the first speaker and get your priorities across the finish line. So that's just kind of the inner gridlock that you're seeing.
So, Adam, these Medicaid cuts allegedly went into effect at midnight last night. It's now October the 1st. And if you're sitting here listening and you are a Medicaid recipient, what does this mean to you? What will it mean for them? What will it mean for rural hospitals or any healthcare providers or hospitals for that matter as of today?
Sure. Yeah, let's just go back a step and talk about what the Medicaid rebase is. So basically every year, the General Assembly needs to set a new, things like inflation happen, things like the number of people enrolled in Medicaid happen. So the General Assembly needs to put a new amount of money into the state's program. This year, that number has been a moving target. The Stein administration asked for one number in its budget back in March. It moved by July. It moved again by August. I'm hearing some murmurs that it might have moved again more recently. So when they came back last week, both the Senate and the House had a $690 million number. They just had different things in their bills. So they didn't get to an agreement on it. So they have the same number even. They just aren't agreeing because of other things. Now, if you're a Medicaid recipient, your provider is getting paid less for your service. And that kind of depends on the service. If you go to a hospital, it's 10% less. It's kind of all over the place, usually between 3% and 10%.
So let's get into the weeds on this a little bit, because it's very confusing. At least it was for me yesterday. Governor Josh Stein continued to argue that the General Assembly should make up what his administration says is a $319 million shortfall in Medicaid funding. And he told reporters that the General Assembly had not allotted, he said this many times in the past, had not allotted enough money for what they know the program needs. So, Kyle, will that money continue to flow despite the lack of a budget until it runs out? Will it run out with no budget, or will it just continue to flow at the set amount that has been previously set?
No, I will say I'm not our newsroom's resident Medicaid expert, so that might be better handled by Brian or Adam. But as far as I understand, there's some flexibility in how these things go.
Okay. Who wants to take that? Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, I mean, basically the problem is that this program doesn't have the money that state officials believe it needs through June 30th, 2026, so through the end of the fiscal year. And what Stein is arguing is that, you know, the target has moved because enrollment has moved, things have changed, costs have risen up. And so if you're a Republican legislature, you're pointing the finger at the governor and his administration saying, you know, you keep moving the goalposts on us and we have plans to come back, but we can't keep playing whack-a-mole here, or it takes time to do these proposals, usually not spur of the moment. And Stein's perspective is, y'all agree in the House, y'all agree in the Senate, forget the extra stuff, just come to the table and do what you agree on. And so that's the frustrating part for the governor, I think, right now.
And of course, this has become a political football, because the Department of Health and Human Services, under the Stein administration, plans rate reductions to stretch the money longer than it would go now, because there's not enough money to go around, according to them. That's come under criticism from Republicans in the General Assembly, who say it is unnecessary and politically motivated, and cutting this money is creating a fake crisis. But earlier in the year, the General Assembly did agree to take the money from $500 to $690 million should the budget pass. So they do see, they acknowledge a problem there. Otherwise, they wouldn't have done that. Who's going to get the blame for this? Are Democrats going to get the blame for handing out less money over time to stretch out what's there to them? Or Republicans for not settling their differences, passing a budget and increasing the amount of money that they have acknowledged needs to be passed?
I think that's a really a moving target. And it's important here to say they don't need to pass a full budget to do this. They can do this in a separate bill. They can fund the Medicaid program separately, like they ostensibly tried to last week.
Yeah. Mike, I think as far as who's to get the blame, I think you'd referenced a post from Senator Berger, or there was something in there about pointing fingers of the governor being political. The immediate reaction. So on Monday last week, I asked Senator Berger, I was like, so if assuming the House doesn't take up your bill, which surprise, surprise, they didn't, who's to blame? And he initially said, you know, ask the House about why they went against their word on 2023 budget. And then the next day he's like, well, let's point fingers at the Democratic governor. And then when I asked Speaker Dustin Hall in the House who's to blame, he was like, ask the House about what, you know, that we don't change things back and forth from session to session. I'm the new speaker. We have different priorities maybe. And so the immediate reaction among Republicans was to blame each other on the House and Senate side. And then it seemed like the next day they might have gotten their messaging in line and said, you know, maybe we could unite against the Democrat.
So clearly there's blame to go around on all three sides, House, Senate, and the governor's mansion. And the legislature does not plan to reconvene until October 20th. We're going to talk about that and more when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about, we're giving a little legislative update here this morning to find out what they did and didn't do in the most recent get-together in Raleigh, which was last week, and we're talking about it with Adam Wagner, who's editor-reporter for NC Newsroom. Kyle Ingram is a politics reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer, and Brian Anderson is a freelance journalist who runs the Anderson Alerts Substack newsletter. I left out the word alerts in the last time I mentioned it, and that alerted Brian to tell me to put that in, so I've done it. I've done my job here. So, Brian, the legislature does not plan to reconvene until October the 20th, which means nothing will happen about anything that we've been talking about until then, I would presume. These cuts to Medicaid will hit low-income families and seniors and people with disabilities the hardest. Will there be no political fallout from this?
I mean, I think right now you're going to see a lot of political fallout just in terms of the federal government shutdown, and that might kind of take over the oxygen that any fallout at the state level was going to happen. But, you know, certainly there's going to be a general frustration with state and federal government. But how many people are paying attention in a municipal election year with like 1 to 5% turnout, depending on your area? This is usually not the year, unfortunately, for us as reporters, where people are paying as close attention to the inner workings of state government. But certainly there's going to be some fallout from this, and people specifically in rural health communities like Goldsboro, like East Carolina University folks, the Children's Hospital folks who wanted some funding, there's going to be a lot of frustration to be had.
Go ahead, Kyle. Go ahead.
I just think with these sort of things, it's difficult for voters in general to know where to place the blame because we have such a strange state politically. I mean, ostensibly, our highest elected official is the governor, who is a Democrat. But our legislature is also one of the most powerful in the country. And so they do many, many of these things without any input from the governor. They're one vote shy of a supermajority this session in 2023. They were able to do many bills without his approval. So it's really hard for voters to be able to pick through all of that whenever it comes time to play the blame game.
And in fact, we spoke about this yesterday when we were talking about the North Carolina Constitution, that the governor is probably the 50th weakest governor in the country by design, and becoming more so because of machinations in the legislature. Adam, do you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I think that one thing that was telling last week, I think the politicians are worried about getting blamed for this. And I think that three-way finger pointing that we started to see last week shows that they are concerned that if people's providers start pulling out of Medicaid, or if services stop becoming available, or if people can't get their GLP-1s, I think that there is some concern in Raleigh about who's going to get the phone calls and the eventual blame for that.
This is not I'm just thinking back on this, Kyle. This is not the first time this budget impasse thing has happened. Not the first time that it's taken a long time to pass a budget. So how out of the ordinary is what we're going through right now with regard to the budget? And what will it take, if history is any guide, to break the logjam?
Not out of the ordinary at all. This has become a very frequent fight between the House and the Senate. One would think that with both chambers dominated by Republicans, passing a budget would be a pretty smooth process. But again, you constantly come up against these ideological differences between House and Senate Republicans, where the Senate is wanting more aggressive tax cuts and lower raises. The House wants the opposite of that. In 2023, this impasse lasted for quite a while. There was also some fights going on over whether to legalize more casinos in the state. But there are talks happening behind closed doors. There are appointed budget chairs from each chamber who are having discussions with one another. And in 2023, the deal dropped out of nowhere. I mean, reporters got the press conference announcement like 2 hours before it happened. And then we're all at the General Assembly at 7 p.m. in the middle of the week hearing, hey, we did it. So I wouldn't rule out the same thing happening this time.
And getting back to what Adam was just talking about a second ago, Brian, with regard to politicians maybe being worried about what might happen as a result of not fully funding Medicaid, you report that when asked what he would tell Medicaid patients who want their benefits maintained and who don't really care about all of the goings on in Raleigh, Republican Senate leader Phil Berger said this, quote, People understand when you have an agreement with someone and they say they're going to do something and then the next day they say they're not going to do what they had previously agreed to. People agree or understand that. That's exactly what's happening here. End quote. What? I'm confused.
He might have some more faith in the ability of everyday North Carolinians to detect the nuances of a multi-year long fight between the inner workings of the House and Senate than maybe I would. But here's what I'll say. You know, Senator Berger, there was a time in 2023 where he thought he had a deal on a budget, I think early in the summer. And then there were some posts from Don Jr. on casinos and other things that had delayed things. So there has been a pattern of Berger feeling like he had an agreement or agreement in principle with the House, and then circumstances either changed. And so here in this case, the only circumstance that's changed is a new speaker. I'm not aware of anything that Dustin Hall has agreed to that he personally has gone back on. But I did ask Speaker Hall, and he had maybe an even funnier quote to me when I asked him about where he is right now. And, you know, has a single thing changed since talks collapsed in June? And he replied to me, he said, and I'm quoting here, "If anything has changed, both sides are even more clear at this point where the other side stands. And both sides have a sense of steadfastness, maybe of the other side. And on the House side, we're even more aware of the righteousness of our cause." Those are his words, not exactly a sign of progress since June. So maybe in October we'll have a surprise deal, but as of now, it's not looking so hot.
And there's another force working at work here against Medicaid and in other avenues, Donald Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill. When North Carolina finally signed on to Medicaid expansion, and we were late to the game, but they did so with the proviso that the federal government would cover 90% of the cost, Kyle. But the Big Beautiful Bill reduced federal contributions to states and shifted funding responsibilities to the states. North Carolina could lose $38 to $50 million over 10 years. And Senate leader Phil Berger helped push the state toward Medicaid expansion. But he also supported the Big Beautiful Bill. Even though he didn't get to vote on it, he threw his weight behind it. So explain that. You can't have it both ways.
I think this is a conflict that Republicans are having to deal with. I mean, this is one of the big reasons that Tom Tillis isn't running for re-election. I mean, you saw him break with the party on this specific issue on how this would affect Medicaid for North Carolinians, gave a long speech about it in the Senate, and then very quickly announced he was going to be abandoning his re-election campaign. So I'm not sure how you do square that. I think it's going to be a question that voters are going to continue asking.
So, Adam, we have these cuts coming from Washington on almost everything. And a lot of what's going to happen in Washington is now is up in the air because we don't know how long this government shutdown will last or what the full impact of that will be. But why aren't the cuts to Medicaid in the Big Beautiful Bill adding some urgency to state legislators and their need to increase funding, which they've already acknowledged? It seems to be that one would influence the other, but it doesn't seem to be. Am I wrong about that?
I think the part of it is that the Big Beautiful Bill's impact's timing is spaced out. And cynically, it is spaced out to lessen the political impact to the Republican Party. A lot of the large impacts come after the midterms. Some more come after this presidential term ends. Some more come a few years after that. But beyond that, I think that DHHS and the health system writ large are still just trying to figure out really what does that piece of legislation mean. It is a huge bill. There are a lot of pieces to it. There's a lot of little intricate things that could mean hundreds of millions of dollars go one way or the other. So I think that the General Assembly knows that they're going to have to do something. I think that they don't yet know what they're going to have to do when. And we've seen that this General Assembly does not throw hundreds of millions of dollars around without knowing exactly when and why they need to do it.
So cuts are kicking in today. in North Carolina, Brian, and if Adam is right, and Adam is not the lone person saying that a lot of these provisions of the Big Beautiful Bill are by design scheduled to kick in after the 2026 midterms and then again after the next presidential election, so they won't be felt by many people until it's too late. But we're already feeling some of this, it seems to me. So do you think average people understand that things are getting bad now, but they're really going to get bad after the next election? And if you don't feel it till after the next election, you're liable to vote against your own self-interest. Do you think that people know that?
I think people are going to start seeing tangible impacts in this month. Not everybody who's on Medicaid goes to the doctor frequently. And so it might take some time. The next time someone tries to get healthcare services might not be this month, might be after there's a potential resolution from state lawmakers. What I would say is, to Adam's point, this for at least for the federal government side and how it impacts North Carolina, the sky is not falling tomorrow. The sky is falling probably 2 years from now, maybe a year from now. And I think people usually generally in government and politics struggle to understand the magnitude of something until it's already happened or until it's just on the brink of happening. So I think what you're seeing from Democrats, especially the state party lawmakers, is this call of the sky's falling tomorrow. This is such an urgent crisis. And for health systems who rely on Medicaid, especially in rural areas, it is a crisis. But for tangible, everyday North Carolinians, the immediate impact right now is maybe some longer delays, some cuts to services, and no GLP-1 drugs like Wegovy if you use that solely for like weight loss. But right. If you use it for things like other chronic conditions, then it's still a benefit. So it's complicated, but the bottom line is I don't think the urgency has set in yet because the issue is not most imminent for another year or two.
So here's what I don't understand, Kyle. Clearly, average people don't follow this like reporters do, and they may not know what's coming down the pike, even though we've been talking about it for 3 years. They have their lives to live, and they're not paying attention, while we are, because that's our job. So a lot of the individuals who are going to be affected by these cuts to Medicaid and the federal cuts to the Affordable Care Act are people who don't have a lot of heft when it comes to political influence. They are lower socioeconomic people. Many of them don't vote, and therefore maybe they're getting the short end of the stick. But hospital systems, healthcare providers, are also being impacted by this. They are powerful lobbies. Why aren't they kicking up some dust?
That's a great question. And I wonder if we'll see more activism from them as we reach the midterms closer. I mean, as you mentioned, these are powerful PACs. They have influence in North Carolina. There's nurse associations, physicians associations, and they invest in these campaigns. And I wonder if there's even conversations happening right now about how to best respond to this, whether it be funding primary challenges or whether it be shifting their support to another party.
I'll just say, Mike, from the perspective of if someone were a lobbyist, you kind of want your work to be a little bit behind the scenes. You don't want to be outwardly criticizing the speaker and Berger. That might not bode well for your fortunes. So just because we're not hearing these advocacy groups speaking very loudly, that doesn't mean activity isn't happening behind the scenes.
Okay. Let's talk about, we've been talking about things that didn't happen in Raleigh in the last week. Let's talk about some of the things that did. Adam, the murder of Irina Zarutska on August 22nd on Charlotte's Blue Line commuter train or light rail train has gotten international attention. And last week, the legislature passed a bill called Irina's Law. Were the provisions in this bill, which we will talk about in a moment, were they even on legislators' minds prior to this heinous murder?
I don't believe so. I think that Irina's murder and the circumstances that led up to it really led directly to the package that we saw. The one thing that was in there that has been tried before was Senator Berger's effort to kind of revitalize the death penalty in North mm-hmm. Carolina. And this has become a package that could allow for that.
And to be clear, the death penalty was never taken off the books. It just, they had hit the pause button on it, I think, in large part because we were using lethal injection. Those drugs became very difficult to get, and there was some question about the humaneness of using them if you didn't use them correctly, if there is a correct way to use them. But now they've unpaused the pause button. But what else is in this bill, this Irina's Law bill, Adam, that they passed last week?
So there are some more prosecutors from Mecklenburg County. There is a new kind of level of oversight of magistrates. We make these decisions every day to what bail to give people. You know, should you be on a secure bond? Should you be on an unsecured bond? If someone comes in and they have a history of mental illness and violent crime, the magistrate is now going to have to justify that decision in writing, which is an issue that we saw with the Carlos Brown, the person that killed Irina Zarutska. There is no longer a written promise to appear. There would no longer be a written promise to appear in state law. So now there will be some kind of bond, almost no matter what. Carlos Brown was free on a written promise to appear. There's a litany of changes. As far as the death penalty goes, it would put a time, basically a shot clock on the appeal process of 2 years. There are appeals, death penalty appeals in North Carolina that have been going on for decades. And it would also do this thing where lethal injection would be North Carolina's basically preferred method of execution. But if it isn't available, the state would need to pick another method. And it would need to be one that's already in use by another state, which would mean things like, it would need to be like the firing squad or electrocution or asphyxiation by a certain kind of gas.
Republicans position the bill as one that would make North Carolina safer, Brian, but Democrats say it's about politics. They criticize the bill for not focusing enough on the root causes of crime, including mental illness. And the man who murdered Irina Zarutska allegedly suffers from schizophrenia. His family had him committed. He could only be committed for 7 days, I think, before they had to release him. Are there any provisions for treatment or for mental illness, or only provisions for punishment? Are there parts of this bill aimed at prevention, like treatment for mental illness, versus punishment, which is reactive rather than proactive and really doesn't prevent crime?
There are some involuntary commitment changes that are there. So that's not just a after-the-fact accountability measure. That's also trying to be a little bit more proactive. But to your point, there's a lot of funding that's not in the bill.
Okay, I asked you a question that you really couldn't answer in the time allotted. I'll maybe give you more chance.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the Gambrill Center at Queens, presenting Earthwise, a public series exploring our connection to nature through science, film, art, literature, and lived stories, part of their Connected Campus program. More at gambrillcenter.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're getting a little legislative update because they were back in session last week and what they did and did not do with Kyle Ingram, politics reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer, Adam Wagner, editor and reporter for NC Newsroom, which is a journalism collaborative of which WFAE is a participant, and Brian Anderson is the freelance journalist who runs the Anderson Alerts Substack newsletter. So the Democrats have called this crime bill that they passed last week about politics. Republicans say it makes us safer. Brian, I asked you an unfair question because you only had 15 seconds to answer it. And that is there anything in this bill that the Democrats like? In other words, a lot of it seems to be reactive, and punishment, you can argue this till you're blue in the face, I suppose, but even the death penalty may not be a deterrent to crime, particularly if the person committing that crime has a mental problem for which there is no treatment or limited treatment for that, which would be proactive. So is there anything in the bill that's proactive?
Yes. And so what I'll say first to your point on Democrats and how they're labeling this bill, it had support of 17 House Democrats. That's kind of forcing Stein's hand here. Like if he signs it or doesn't sign it, you're not going to keep 17 House Democrats in line to sustain a veto. So this bill should become law one way or the other, regardless of what the governor does, because it has that strong support from House Democrats. That's over a third of the caucus. So it's not a complete party line issue. Right. What is proactive in the bill? Well, there's more explicit instructions for magistrates on how to deal with these potentially violent individuals with mental health issues. And so basically court officials could try and be more proactive in getting mental health evaluations. There's also a collaborative that's directed to study execution methods and the intersection of mental health and criminal justice system. But as reporters know, task forces and commissions aren't policy-making entities. They are ones that may make recommendations that reaffirm what lawmakers had already thought and just need an excuse to point to in order to implement. So the biggest criticism I have heard of the bill is that there isn't enough mental health funding, which is what many Democrats see as the root of this and so many other problems.
And Kyle, the governor has called for more mental health funding, but he also, when he was attorney general, was a supporter of the death penalty, which is heavily, has returned as a result of this bill. So is he likely to sign or veto? And Brian says it doesn't matter whether he does or not, it's going to pass. It's going to become law. But is he likely to sign or veto it?
He's keeping his cards extremely close to his chest on this one. He's been asked that question many, many times since the bill has come to his desk. He's not given a definitive answer either way. He said he's reviewing it. I see this as a super difficult political decision for him to make. Obviously, there is a lot of anger about that murder that was a horrible event for Charlotte and for the state. And people want him to act on this, but it would also require him to do things that I think would go against some of his base, some of the party's wishes. And I did want to note, I think this bill appeared to have a lot more Democratic support before it was amended. So when this first went to the Senate floor, it didn't include the provision about using different methods of execution if lethal injection was ruled unconstitutional. Senate Leader Phil Berger added that as an amendment on the floor, and you immediately saw Senate Democrats be completely shocked by this change. And that is when they started getting up and filing their paperwork to be marked as absent or present on the vote and walking out to not vote on it and not give their support. I think if you hadn't seen that amendment, it probably would have passed with broader Democratic support.
This murder on the Blue Line has launched a series of investigations at every level of government, from the federal government on down. And this week, I think it was Monday, a U.S. House Judiciary Committee subcommittee on oversight held a field hearing here in Charlotte entitled Victims of Violent Crime. This was a reaction to Irina Zarudzka's murder, at which Republican members of that committee criticized Charlotte's judicial system as a, quote, revolving door for criminals, and which sparked debate over bail reform and mental health services, including funding for prosecutors. Adam, I think it was you that pointed out that Raleigh did provide more funding in this arena's bill for prosecutors. I think 10 additional prosecutors will be coming to the district attorney's office. Spencer Merriweather, our district attorney, has complained for years on this program about not having enough prosecutors. And in fact, over the last, I think, 10 or 15 years, he's only been able to add one in a city that grows by 150 people every single day. So if we get 10 prosecutors, but you don't get greater court capacity, what good is that? Because there's already a backlog of cases in the courts. The courts complain that they can't handle the cases that they have now. So now you have 10 extra prosecutors. Is there anything in this bill to increase the court's capacity? Adam.
Not that I saw. There is more oversight of them. So there is more kind of pressure on magistrates to do their jobs well. But no, there weren't additional magistrates or additional clerks or additional office staff or anything like that.
Well, it's also additional judges, because if you can't bring a case to trial because there's no room in the courtroom and there's no judges to try the case, then Then what? That is the question that the courts, too, have been asking in Mecklenburg County for years. Brian, the courts have also been criticized, and this came up in this conversation, for how magistrates rule on these hearings that lead to whether a person gets bail or serves time in jail prior to their going to trial. And much of that routine has been the Democratic government of Charlotte has been getting criticized for this, but much of that is prescribed by state law, which was written and passed by the Republican legislature. And a couple of years ago, WBTV revealed that magistrates throughout the state have fewer qualifications, less oversight, and more power than similar judicial officials in other states. What does this law do to address that?
One thing we reporters have joked about is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and the state auditor have gotten a lot more powers than the governor lately, and in some ways are more impactful. And one of the ways in this bill creates some change is with Chief Justice Paul Newby, where he can basically see a problematic magistrate in his eyes, or someone who is creating a quote-unquote revolving door, and they could pay, the Chief Justice could create a pathway for that person to be fired, like basically initiate suspension proceedings, and that's an accountability measure.
But aren't these magistrates following the rules set out by the legislature that govern who can get out and who can't get out? So why would firing the magistrate be the answer to the question as opposed to changing the rules?
That's a very good point, and that's something lawmakers are saying. This is kind of a starting point of the bill. But the other thing I would just say is there was a Pretrial Integrity Act. There have been other laws in the past where lawmakers have tried to do this. But to your point, it's been a GOP legislature since 2011. And no matter what is happening here in Charlotte and Mecklenburg County, with this this incident that happened in August, a Democratic lawmaker pointed out to me, you know, even if the magistrate wanted to prevent this person from being off the streets, they would have gotten back on the streets in like April or May because of statutory requirements allowing like mandating how long you can hold someone. So there's, to your point, there is only so much people can do because of maybe the strictness of these laws, and that's a conversation lawmakers are still having. This is kind of how they presented it as like our first attempt to address this. Yeah.
And just jumping in there for a second, I think it was, Brian, I think it was your question at the original press conference about what in this bill would have actually prevented this. And I think if you want to recall Berger's answer to that.
Yeah, so I had basically, you know, asked what would be done to prevent this, and there wasn't a great answer. There was some finger pointing on magistrates and executive orders and a desire to create more accountability. But I'm not aware of, you know, how this would be prevented other than maybe the magistrate would have gotten suspension proceedings because of this that could now be initiated by the Supreme Court justice. So really, it's hard to say whether this would have prevented the Charlotte incident from happening, but based on the statutory law, it seems like that criminal might have been able to go back on the streets.
Kyle.
I also just wanted to note that I think Chief Justice Newby himself has expressed an interest in changing the rules around this. So while before the legislature even got IRENA's law across the finish line, Newby announced the creation of a pretrial release task force. So that group is going to include a different number of stakeholders in the state judicial system and is going to be making recommendations on changing pretrial release practices in the state. So obviously some of that is going to have to be statutory, but there's some leeway within the court system for Newby to direct his own changes.
I want to ask a question that none of you may be able to answer, and that's okay if you can. I just want to know if you can. And that is this. The individual who allegedly killed IRENA Zarudzka had been in the court system for years on much lower level crimes than this. And there has been a push by the district attorney here over time to have cashless bail, because his argument is that for these low level infractions, if you can't make bail, then your life situation gets worse because you're in there for something that really doesn't matter. It doesn't threaten the community at large, but it could cause you to lose your house, your family, your job, etc. So they have this cashless bail system. But would this individual, DeCarlos Brown, have gotten out of jail with an allegation of murder? Or would he have automatically been held till trial? Do we know?
I don't know Charlotte's rules on that. But
well, it would say, wait a minute. Is it a Charlotte rule or is it a state rule?
I think it's the prosecutorial district has basically a rubric. Brian Kyle might have a better answer on this than I do.
All right. Well, I don't think they do. And so we'll move on. But I'll ask that question of one of our local guys later on. Kyle, lawmakers also had time last week in the wake of the Charlie Kirk assassination to advance a bill defining political violence as a new crime with higher consequences. It's a Senate bill that passed the House already, 105-6. Has it gone to the Senate? Did they already pass it? How does this work?
No,
so it's a Senate bill that the House voted on first. Okay.
Yeah. So once we reach the crossover period, which is when bills have to cross over into each chamber, things can get a little wonky where one chamber can take a bill that's already passed another chamber and then basically completely gut it and rewrite it. And that's what happened with this one. So when the Senate originally passed this bill, it wasn't the political violence bill. But that has gone through the House. As you mentioned, it raises the penalties for political violence, which is a newly defined statutory term in this bill.
How do they define it?
So it would be violence directed. It's a pretty broad definition, but it says violence that is found to have been caused by someone's beliefs, perspectives, candidacy for political office, I believe party affiliation, a pretty broad list of terms. And it would raise the felony level of anyone who is found to have engaged in it. And I think it also increases the likelihood that someone who is found to have engaged in political violence could get the death penalty.
There were six Democrats who voted no. That's the vote was 105-6. Why did they vote no?
So you didn't actually hear a lot from the Democrats who voted no. They were all members of the House Progressive Caucus. And one of the votes for no was Representative Maria Cervania, who is a Wake County legislator. And she had proposed an amendment to the bill that would also define hate crimes, which is something that Democrats have tried to do multiple times in the legislature throughout the years. It would create a new crime for attacking someone based on their race, their sexual orientation, et cetera. Republicans defeated that amendment. And she said, I think this bill would have been better if we were able to be more expansive in the sorts of violence that we were looking to stamp out.
So I have 2 minutes left, and I want to cover this before we end the program. Texas recently engaged in redrawing voting districts outside of the period in which it usually happens, which usually follows the census, which comes our way every 10 years. And they did so at the request of Donald Trump to bolster Republicans' numbers heading into the midterms. Trump asked Texas to find him, this sounds familiar, five more Republican House seats. Of course, that prompted Gavin Newsom, California's governor, to ask the legislature there for permission to put a referendum on their ballot to do the same thing, redistrict, and the voters will make that decision in November. And other states are considering similar moves, including ours. North Carolina's Republican Senate leader Phil Berger posted on X just that possibility. What kind of reaction, Adam, has that idea received here?
So Governor Stein was asked about this yesterday, and he basically said that redistricting again would be absurd, that we can't constantly be redistricting. I would maybe argue that North Carolina's recent history says otherwise, because we are constantly redistricting.
And to be clear, political gerrymandering is legal. Racial gerrymandering is unconstitutional, but the Supreme Court says political gerrymandering is legal. But as you report, Kyle, Phil Berger, in announcing his thinking on X, called out California Governor Gavin Newsom for trying to, quote, steal the Republican majority in Congress. We know that shame has left the building when it comes to politics in this country. Is blatant hypocrisy also on vacation?
I mean, that's a difficult question to answer, but look, this state has been gerrymandered for decades upon decades. The Democrats did it when they were in power. Republicans have done it since they've come into power. And it is pretty brazen. I mean, when you saw the redraw happen in 2023, at the time, House Speaker Dustin Hall was the chair of the Rules Committee, and he admitted the districts were drawn to favor Republicans because the U.S. Supreme Court and the state Supreme Court have basically said that's okay. I mean, the state Supreme Court said it's a political question they can't answer. But yeah, I mean, that's the way that it's moving towards. Even if there's very little to gain from another redistricting, Republicans could get maybe one more seat in Congress.
Okay, so it wouldn't be much of a gain, but we'll see. Have to stay tuned to see what happens. That is Kyle Ingram, a politics reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer. Also with us, Adam Wagner, editor and reporter for NC Newsroom, and Brian Anderson, the brains behind the Anderson Alerts Substack newsletter. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.